This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Happy Thursday, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us. It's another day of Let's Go There, and we've got a lot coming for you. But first, let's remember it's Constitution Day. 1787, today commemorates the signing of the U.S. Constitution. What does that mean to you, Ryan?
The one that was signed by like actual rapists and slave owners. And, you know, in the midst of civil unrest, you want to bring up that it's Constitution Day?
I just thought I'd bring it up just to let you know. And producer Chance added it to the outline.
Well, guys, if you didn't know what privilege was before, you do now.
It's also 47 days until the election.
Now, there we go. That's actual good information to know. To know that we're right around the corner from learning who's on the right side of history.
And maybe that person who's voted in will somehow change the Constitution.
Someone mute Shira's mic immediately.
I think either way, no matter either side that it happens, something's going to happen to the Constitution, which is
also coming from someone who can't vote.
I know that's true, which is why I was going to work. You know, we talked about being a poll worker and I said that I wanted to do that. And then I was reminded by
I love you want to be a poll worker. I don't know to be. I mean, I know we found out about like what it would be to like what you would have to do, but I feel like it's not as boring as it sounds.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't even thinking about the boring part. I just thought it's a good way to be of service right now. But once again, we're working on that day. So I guess that's not going to happen.
Well, we are going to be working. We're going to be keeping you up on all
this. Yes, we're working that day. And that's a service that it's important.
Oh, Shira. Oh, God. Let's get into the show today.
Let's get into what's trending this hour. President Trump signed an executive order to establish a national commission to promote patriotic education. He made that announcement about what he has dubbed as the 1776 Commission at the first White House conference on American history. He said the commission will be aimed at establishing patriotic and pro-America education that will celebrate American history. And, you know, I think the reason why he's saying the 1776 one is because he's also, I feel like he's criticizing and also making fun of the 1619 Project, which is the New York Times project that explores slavery's legacy, which is why, by the way, the Constitution part, when I said, who knows what will happen, someone might redo the Constitution for better or worse, because look at things like this that are being announced. And here's what he had to say about it.
Today, the left-wing rioting and mayhem are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. Our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history. The left has warped, distorted, and defiled the American story.
This scares me, the fact that he says, you know, the left and the left-leaning stuff that people are learning in schools. This is why we're having the protests today. It's very worrisome. Now, President Donald Trump also called out his Republican allies for proposing too small of a relief package and encouraging both parties in Congress to go for a bigger one that would include his priority of $1,200 stimulus checks for most Americans. So with that said, now you're like, oh, wow, he's fighting for something good.
No.
What's going on here?
No, every good villain has a good side in them. Let's be honest. I mean, Thanos wanted to ruin the world, but he made a good point. He made some very valid points about ruining the world. So I think he can, there's duality. I think he can be this person that thinks this, but also be totally evil.
two truths can't exist, I guess. Mm-hmm. And right now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says any deal will have to include far more than just another set of, quote, Trump checks and a handful of other priorities. Now, a former model has come forward to accuse Donald Trump of sexually assaulting her at the U.S. Open tennis tournament more than two decades ago in an alleged incident that left her feeling sick and violated. And in an exclusive interview with The Guardian, Amy Doris, that's this person's name, alleged that Trump accosted her outside the bathroom in his VIP box at the tournament in New York on September 5th, 1997. She was 24 at the time. And I'm not going to get into the details of what she says, but you can check it all out on theguardian.com right now.
That's that duality we were talking about. He's evil.
All right. Yes. And that was what's trending this hour.
Yes. The T Report, those pop culture stories that are trending right now. Super quickly, Netflix's Cheer star, Jerry Harris, we talked about him yesterday because he was being investigated by FBI and... it's kind of really sad. So basically, he has been arrested for child pornography. He was arrested Thursday morning in Illinois and is being hit with a charge of production of child pornography, according to the assistant U.S. attorney, Joseph D. Fitzpatrick. As reported, Harris was under investigation by the FBI for allegedly soliciting minors for sex back in May 2019. And unfortunately, he has been arrested. According to the feds, the parents of two male children, both 14, claims that Harris had contacted both of the boys online and repeatedly solicited child pornography images and videos. I wanted to give an update on that. And that is your T Report and those pop culture moments that are trending right now.
Okay, now coming up, a whistleblower is exposing federal officials for trying to secure weapons that they don't even use in war to use against rioters and protesters. More details on that next in 2 minutes. A whistleblower, D.C. National Guard Major Adam DiDemarco, told lawmakers that defense officials were searching for crowd control technology that was too unpredictable to use in war zones and had authorized the transfer of about 7,000 rounds of ammunition to the D.C. Armory as protests over there were happening in Washington. And now this is out. A lot of people are talking. And back with us is Marissa Lang from The Washington Post. Thanks again for being here.
Happy to be here.
So why is this revelation so significant? Why should people be taking notice?
So I think what was really surprising to me was just the kinds of weapons and ammunition that were detailed in this whistleblower report. The LRAD system, for example, is something that we do see at protests because it's used to make loud announcements. It can be used more aggressively to emit this like really high-pitched ear-splitting noise that can hurt people, but it is used to make a large announcement, for example, to a big crowd. But the ADS system, for example, which is the active denial system, also known as a heat ray.
It was
really surprising. I had never heard of anything like that being floated to bring to a protest. And then, as you all mentioned, also the stockpiling of live ammunition rounds. Obviously, when you're doing crowd control, most law enforcement would tell you that the goal is to de-escalate. So anything like a live ammunition is pretty unusual to have in store for what would be a peaceful protest.
I mean, the list of things that you just named off sounds like we live where Batman lives in Gotham. It felt kind of cartoonish. It felt very fictional. I mean, a heat ray just sounds wild. But let's talk about how Trump is really kind of pushing this narrative when it comes into law and order. What does that necessarily mean when he's saying it versus what we're seeing here and how the stockpiling and all these weapons are kind of being used for peaceful protesters? It really feels alarming.
Sure. Well, so I don't think it's been any secret. The Trump administration has come down really hard on protests. They've talked about charging protesters, for example, with the Sedition Act. Just recently, Bill Barr mentioned that. There's certainly been a push to have this crackdown response with heavily armed federal officers. And I think, as you pointed out, Ryan, that all kind of goes right along with this law and order messaging of they're going to be tough on any kind of crime that happens, any kind of behavior that they think is unacceptable.
Again, we're talking to Marissa Lang from the Washington Post about this whistleblower that came out with this information that that the government was trying to get 7,000 rounds of ammunition, a heat ray device, all these other things as they were prepping to deal with protesters in Washington. I guess now that this information is out, what happens next? Will it matter?
So there is an active investigation ongoing. Congress is looking into this. The reason that this information came out is this whistleblower stepped up and went to Congress and said, hey, you know, I'm a member of the DC National Guard, and this was really disturbing to me. And so he filed a report with lawmakers who are going to continue to investigate. I got a copy of his claims, and so that's where the story came from. But this is all part of an ongoing investigation into what exactly did happen on June 1st when federal forces were used to clear out these peaceful protesters from in front of the White House.
And also, let's talk funding. Like, who's, I mean, obviously, this is being funded. All of this stuff is being funded. When it seems like, in particular, in a moment like this, people are still wanting a stimulus package. They're still needing that money. So it's kind of like, where does this funding really kind of divide in terms of, like, we're seeing so much of these weapons and kind of hearing stories like this. Where does that really fall when we're looking into this?
Sure. Well, a lot of this is coming out of the Department of Defense, and the DOD has a very big budget, as I'm sure we all know. So it is coming from different funding streams. It's not like Congress is writing a blank check for heat ray devices, but they do have, you know, all these weapons kind of in storage, right? This heat ray device, for example, was made more than 10 years ago. It was made in the early 2000s. And so a lot of these things are things that they already have in stock and that they're just looking into, you know, do we have it? Can we get it? Kind of what the status of them are.
Who would need a heat ray?
What does even that do? I don't get it.
So a heat ray, it does sound very science fiction-y when you say it, but
yes.
It's this device that essentially emits this invisible beam. And if you're standing in the way, what it does is it's kind of like a microwave. It uses microwave technology.
OMG.
So it heats up the water molecules in your skin, and it makes it feel like your skin is burning.
What? How is this legal to use on people? Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, that's why this they had
this is crazy.
Concerns.
This sounds very scary and crazy. Would this be a bad look on Trump and the new administration as he goes into this election cycle? Will his will voters even care when they hear this information?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't speak to that, but we've certainly been getting a lot of response from folks today who are, I think, reacting like you two are, which is like, what on earth is this? And why would anyone need it?
Well, I love the Washington Post. Y'all are always so great in giving us the 1-2 hitters, letting us know what's really going on.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate you guys.
And yeah, and thank you for your hard work in discussing the story and writing about it. Again, that was Marissa Lang from the Washington Post. Now, coming up next, we discuss how big of a role religion is going to play in this presidential election. That's coming up in 2 minutes. Is religion playing a bigger role in the presidential election than ever before, or is it not as powerful as it once was? Well, joining us right now is Amelia Thompson DeVoe, who's a senior writer for 538. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this is such an important topic to look at as we are getting into the election and looking at numbers and voting. How important is it for religious voters to vote with their values and beliefs?
Well, I think, you know, many voters want to hear from politicians about their own personal faith and how they're going to address the issues that religious voters care about. And this is something that we've particularly heard from Joe Biden on the Democratic side. He's been talking a lot about his Catholic faith and often ties that to sort of experience he's had. With loss, it's a way of connecting with voters, I think, on a more personal level. So many voters do want to hear these kinds of messages from politicians that are running for president.
Which is why when I was reading this article, I found it super interesting that obviously more Americans are kind of identifying as non-religious. But when you think about at the beginning of this election cycle, we had Marianne Williamson, right, who was this kind of spiritual guru everyone thought was a big woo-woo joke. No one took her seriously. So how much should we kind of be thinking about that when we're talking about, you know, these Americans who are kind of spiritual and they're still not taking someone who could have represented them well seriously?
Yeah, I actually wrote an article when Marianne Williamson dropped out of the race. It seems like a very long time ago, about how she seemed like she was sort of positioned to appeal to this growing group of Americans that are spiritual but not religious. And she really didn't land. And I think that just speaks to the complexity of this group of people and how really no politician has figured out how to appeal to them directly, even though they're a very large group, they're a very growing group, but they're not very cohesive politically. And they're not one that's kind of easy to reach in one place. So, Marianne Williamson might have seemed like she was a natural person to reach out to them. Other politicians haven't really figured out how to address them as a block yet either.
So how are we seeing religion impact this election cycle? And you talked a bit about it in terms of Joe Biden, but where are we seeing the numbers and the data? And you do cover this as a senior writer for 538. You guys really look at the data and how it impacts things.
Yeah. So, I mean, what Joe Biden is trying to do this year is, a fairly ambitious play. He's reaching for some voters that are more traditionally Republican, like white evangelical Protestants and Mormons. He seems to see an opportunity there with, perhaps making an argument to those voters that he's a more authentically religious candidate than President Trump is. Obviously, President Trump has gotten very high support from white evangelical Protestants, and he probably will this year too. But I think Biden is thinking that maybe he can peel off a little bit of support there for people who might be a little more skeptical of whether Trump is sort of the candidate with the values that they want. That being said, those groups are very traditionally conservative and Republican. So that's an ambitious play for Biden.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see how successful it is.
Well, it's so annoying because the DNC was basically all about that, right? Targeting those people who are still kind of on the fence. They don't know if they're going to vote for Trump or not. And when I think about kind of the Democratic Party as a whole, it is based off the backs of Black women. And Black folks, genuinely, especially Southern Black folks, are very religious. So it seems like the smarter play would to continue to kind of make sure the presence of, Black women and other women of color are felt heard versus kind of really worrying about these non-religious voters in a sense. Or are they seeing it like, oh, these non-religious voters are younger and we want more of a younger demographic to come out and vote? What, I guess, which one are you seeing kind of play out?
Well, I mean, I do think there are attempts by Democrats to appeal to Black Protestants. As you noted there, when you look at religious groups, they overwhelmingly support Democrats more than any other group. So they're incredibly loyal to the Democratic Party. Politicians like Biden do a lot of outreach to the Black religious community, although arguably maybe not as much as they should or could be doing. I think in terms of political organizing, churches are also kind of a more obvious and natural place for politicians like Biden and, other folks to go to. People are actually gathered there physically. It's a weird moment, but in normal times, they can do things like voter registration drives and sort of keep people updated about this.
Yeah.
So I do think that, in some ways, it's more politically natural for politicians to reach people in spaces, they're not like giving a sermon from the pulpit, but like to sort of reach them through religious spaces, harder to reach these non-religious folks.
Yeah. Do you think that the future, I mean, we're moving towards maybe a country where there are more non-religious voters. Is that going to shift how we look at our politics here?
Well, I think this year, Biden can probably count on pretty high support from non-religious voters. So I don't think it's going to change things much this year. Going forward, though, I think this is something that politicians, particularly on the left, are going to have to grapple with. Do they try to reach out to those voters who are not that religious? And how do they do it?
Yeah, because typically they didn't even want to vote. So who knows if they matter?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. We matter. I'm non-religious, but I matter. Okay, Amelia Thompson DeVoe, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Amelia Thompson DeVoe is a senior writer for 538 and wrote about this topic. Now, next up on Let's Go There, did Attorney General William Barr just compare the lockdown to slavery? Well, we've got the clip coming up in 2 minutes. Attorney General William Barr argued yesterday that coronavirus-related lockdown orders were surpassed only by slavery as the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in the nation's history.
The lockdown stay-at-home orders is like house arrest. It's you know, other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
Okay, now you can see how problematic this statement is, and like, why even compare this? Secondly, I don't even want to get into all the other atrocities that have happened in America to different groups of people, right? Let's not even get into that. The fact that he said it was right after slavery and the fact that he would even connect it or compare it to slavery.
Yeah, I don't know what the obsession is with white people wanting to feel oppressed so bad. I mean, these measures that have been taken by all of the top officials in this country, medical top officials in this country, are to keep everyone alive. I don't understand how that, and you know, wanting to keep you safe is like now being compared to slavery or being oppressed. It's honestly so weird. And I wish, you know, white folks or conservatives or whatever you want to call yourselves at this point could understand that there's bigger issues than them. And if they could step out of their own bubble and understand that all these measures that have been taken are for the greater good versus just being able to go out and just not wear a mask. It sounds like a three-year-old throwing a temper tantrum, in all honesty. That's how immature it sounds.
Well, Representative James Clyburn, who's the number three House Democratic leader, said that Barr's remarks were pretty ridiculous and more. Here it is.
I think that statement by Mr. Barr was the most ridiculous, tone-deaf, god-awful things I've ever heard. It is incredible. The chief law enforcement officer in this country would equate human bondage to expert advice to save lives. Slavery was not about saving lives, it was about devaluing lives. This pandemic is a threat to human life.
And I think he said it really best. He kind of said what is on all of our minds when we heard that statement. And it's problematic, obviously, but also this is a narrative that I feel like I keep hearing from a lot of people who are anti-lockdown, right? And who feel like their civil liberties are being encroached on or being taken away by all of this. So when you hear a representative from the administration talk about it, you can see how then it gives them the power to then continue using it in their own conversation.
Well, this is also the same person, might I add, that William Barr also said that he wasn't sure that, you know, systemic racism was actually a thing. And so this is someone who also during this, you know, conversation that he had when he said what we just played, he also said the person in the white coat is not the grand seer who can come up with the right decision for society. A free people makes its decision through its elected representative. So what happens when those elected representatives like Donald Trump are saying that they're downplaying it and over 200,000 people have died? Where do we go from there?
Not sure. I mean, we're there right now. So thank you for sharing that. Now coming up, a common household product was just proven to kill coronavirus. That is next in What's Trending This Hour. Coming up on the show, how smell can change how we view history. And we've got a sensory historian here for that. I didn't even know that was a thing, but it is.
Would have never guessed it was a thing either, but it's so good. Like hearing him break it down, I can't wait. Oh my God, y'all are going to love it.
Stay tuned for that. But let's get into some What's Trending This Hour, shall we?
Let's do it.
Former President Obama is urging young voters to make a plan for the election in a new video where he tries to be very hip.
You've taught me how to make a mean sourdough starter. It looks awful. You showed me the Renegade Challenge. Renegade. Great name, by the way, which I've been enjoying on my Finsta. So since you've given me so much lately and so much hope over the years, I want to return the favor and help you make a plan in the up. You can vote in person. In many states, you can vote in person before November 3rd. That's a great option. You can also vote in person on Election Day.
Now, again, using comedy to bring in the young votes. You know, I'm trying to brainstorm as we are hitting, what we said, 47 days until the election. Like, what do we need to do? A lot of people are focusing on swing states, the young vote. Like, I thought to myself, do famous people or like TikTok stars need to say, hey, if you vote, you show you voted, I'll do a collaboration with you. I'm going to choose one lucky person to do a collab with. Like, I think we need to start really getting creative here.
Yeah, but that's you even giving a lot to these people, these influencers or these TikTok creators, even giving them as much as like thinking they're interested about it unless they're getting paid.
Or like say Alicia Keys, she would say, maybe my next song, I'm going to collab with one of you, but you need to show
well,
you.
Well, those like people like Alicia Keys are already kind of doing their what they need to do and already working and shown history of working with politicians or working to talk about voting. I feel like they use their, you know, their platforms responsible. But when you're talking about the young votes, and I love the connection that you said to TikTok stars, I do think there's kind of like maybe a lack of not even caring about it, unfortunately. And it is proven when it comes to poll numbers that young voters aren't there.
Yeah, what I'm saying is the Rock the Vote, this, the celebration, they talk a lot about it. But maybe if we said, oh, you know, if you do show you voted or that action was taken, you could win something.
I agree.
But we need to put our creative hats on, Ryan. Me and you, we need to brainstorm.
Stop giving me extra things to do.
Next up on What's Trending This Hour, Clorox wipes are still in short supply due to increased demand. As we know, all of us want to get those Clorox wipes to clean off surfaces and ourselves. Supposedly, there's a new household cleaner that's been added to the list of effective products to help you stay safe from COVID-19. Pine Sol Original Multi-Surface Cleaner. It received approval from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for kill claims against SARS-CoV-2. The virus that causes COVID-19 on hard, non-porous surfaces.
Well, you know, Pine Sol has been around forever, so I'm pretty sure people that use this probably currently are probably very excited to hear this news.
Now, another 860,000 people filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week, and that's a slight decline from the previous week. And as we see, there's been a sluggish recovery in the labor market. The number of continuing claims, though, which represents people filing for ongoing benefits, fell by almost 1 million to 12.6 million. And that is according to a new weekly data from the Department of Labor. Now let's get into some tea. What's going on, Ryan?
All right, let's get into the tea report, those pop culture moments that are trending right now. Ashley Tisdale is pregnant with her first child. How sweet. I mean, I grew up on her. The High School Musical star confirmed that she is expecting her first child with her husband, Christopher French. The couple shared photos where Ashley showed off her bump in a white gown while posing next to her husband, who was also dressed in white. Now, her husband also shared the news on his own Instagram page, and several of the Disney actress celeb pals congratulated the couple on the happy news, including Kaley Cuoco, Hailey Duff, and Amanda Kloots. So French and Tisdale, actually, they got married back in September. So, wow, that came very quick.
You know you're getting old when the High School Musical stars start having babies.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I can't believe it. It's wild. Now, moving on to a tea report that's involving Taylor Swift. So a federal judge has sentenced an Austin, Texas man to 30 months in prison after he pleaded guilty to stalking and sending threatening letters and emails to Taylor Swift's former record label. So according to records filed in federal court, this guy Eric Swarbrick was given the sentence during a hearing Wednesday in Nashville. The terms of the sentence, which also includes the 3 years of supervised release, were agreed on by prosecutors in a plea agreement that Eric entered in 2019. I mean, he sent over 40 letters and emails to Big Machine Label Group in 2018, asking the CEO to introduce him to Swift. Over time, the letters became more violent and threatening. On three occasions, Eric drove to Nashville to personally deliver them. I mean, whoa, this person is wild. I'm not going to use the word crazy because we're not using that term, but wild is literally the best decision.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, it's honestly so wild. But let's move on to another tea report story.
Lots of wilds. Take a shot when you hear the word wild.
Please. Okay, so this is some Real Housewives of Beverly Hills news, right? Teddy Mellencamp, I know you're not a housewife girl, but I am. And she really is not my favorite housewife. She's actually the worst, in my opinion. Okay. And she actually is getting called out because she has this thing called an accountability program. So this program, basically, she's a big fitness girl. She basically...
isn't like personal accountability, like personal growth.
No, it's a fitness thing. So former participants claimed this week that the program restricted them to just 500 calories a day and required an hour of cardiovascular activity. Are you kidding me? You can only eat 500 calories. That is wild to me.
Yeah, that is crazy. The cardio activity, an hour, that's pretty normal. But yes,
no, 500. I'm sorry.
Because doing that at the same time is not healthy.
No, that's not healthy at all. And she got a ton of backlash. And honey, if you want to find out more about that story, head over to WeAreChannelQ.com and keep us followed at LGT Show because, honey, that's your tea report.
Okay, now coming up, are you finding it hard to get out of bed every morning? I know I do. But find out why a morning routine is really essential to making the most of your day. That is next in 2 minutes. All right, we're about to talk about the importance of a morning routine because it can change your life. And our guest, Cody McClain, has too many achievements to list. But in addition to running his first business partly from foster care, he's gone on to write a book, started a podcast, learned rescue diving, became a pilot, photographer, much more. What were you doing, Ryan?
Oh, that's intense. Nothing, clearly.
Today, he's also the founder of a $12 million company that employs over 700 people. He's worked hard to achieve this, and he's only 30 years old. Thank you for joining us, Cody, today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right.
So, Cody, are you telling us that you did all this because you have a good morning routine?
I think it contributed. To clarify, I started my first business when I was 15. I was partly in foster care. And for the majority of my life, I was burnt out because I was a workaholic. I'd wake up, I'd have a bowl of sugary cereal, and I would just work for the rest of the day. And I would stress out time after time, and I would burn out. And I didn't even know what the term burnout was. And eventually, I sold my company, and I was able to invest time in myself. And a part of that self-discovery process is I realized that who we are, the things that we do every single day, that's really who we become. And so one of those things I did, instead of just always working out, burning out, and I invested in myself. And so I created this foundational habit. I like to call it my mind, my body, my soul routine. So I'll meditate for 20 minutes. I'll read a book for 30 minutes. And I'll exercise for 60 minutes. And by investing in yourself, even if I look back at that day and I was unfocused and I didn't feel like I'd get anything done, I'm able to look back and see that I did achieve some level of direction to further my personal development and even my future.
I know the whole thing around the 5 a.m. wake up rule, which a lot of the top CEOs and executives and these life hackers talk about and how that's a game changer. I tried that. And then, we would do our live show at 4 p.m. By the time our live show hit, I wanted to pass out. It wasn't sustainable, I guess, and I was looking at your schedule and I wondered if you wake up at 5 a.m. You actually do 7:30 a.m. So that's manageable. It works for you. You're a young man right now. You don't have kids, I assume.
No.
What do you say to the people that, are parents?
Well, chances are you already have a morning routine, whether it's brushing your teeth, taking a shower, putting on your clothes, and you're doing that in a specific order every single day. And so you can really start by a process of continuous improvements. Imagine if you can improve yourself by 1% every day. And I think those first 60, 90 minutes are the most important part of the day because that really sets the foundation, the bedrock for the rest of the day. And so if you don't have a lot of time, you can look at this idea of what's the smallest possible thing that I can do to further myself in this particular area that feels important to me and that's important to my values.
Oh my God. All right. Cody McClain is with us right now. Entrepreneur. We're talking about the importance of a morning routine.
Okay. But I do love one thing that this article that you wrote speaks about, giving yourself me time before jumping into work. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Because I think that's something that a lot of people forget.
So me time is this concept of investing in yourself. You can have a business and you can be at a job where you're trying to further yourself in that job, but you really have to look at who you are because if you're investing all of your mental energy in this other thing, that may continue to grow. But meanwhile, you may be suffering. You may be dealing with that stress, that anxiety, and Lord knows all the kinds of things that we're dealing with in today's society. And so by thinking about what are the things that I want to do today that is going to make me feel good or that is going to help others around me feel good, that is an important concept because that is really an investment into who you are at your core self because that's going to multiply and compound as the days go by. And a few examples of that, you can do a simple practice called a gratitude journal, where you simply write down three things that you're grateful for, and you really embody that. You don't just write down, I'm grateful for air, for water, et cetera. But if you actually sit with the feeling of what it means to be grateful for water, you may actually start tearing up because you realize just how precious this thing that you have on a daily basis is. And that can make you tremendously more happy and help you deal with stress. Or you think about, what are the three top things I want to work on today? Because often we get bombarded with email and social media, and we let other people dictate our schedule. But if you sit down and ask it, what do you want to work on? Then you're more likely to have that level of accomplishment at the end of the day.
Finally, as we wrap this up, what do you do if some people around you or colleagues make fun of the fact that you do try to create me time?
Oh, because you know I was about to say something as well. And I have another thought. We're not wrapping this up just yet. I have one more question. Answer.
So to respond, I was supposed to, well, just, I mean, screw them. I mean, what are they to say about who you are and the values that you're imposing on yourself that you feel are important to yourself? I mean, I think maybe do it on your own, do it by yourself. But I think at the end of the day, it's, if you feel that what you're trying to do is important to you, then, you know, you have to stay true to yourself, right? Because you can't go be living a lie and live somebody else's life or live the life that your parents wanted you to live.
True.
Let's add some context. Read the room. Know when it's appropriate to do that and when it's not appropriate. I think that's what's going to drive a lot of success. But my thing is, we're in the middle of a pandemic, Cody. This idea of like me time, people and like writing in a gratitude journal about the goodness of water is not the first priority on a lot of people's lists, especially when they're dealing with finances, stresses, everything going on right now. What do you say to that? Because that can be difficult trying to even find the time. It seems kind of honestly irresponsible if you're thinking about it.
Well, chances are you're finding the time to open up social media, to browse through TikTok. How many hours a day do we spend on our phones? Yeah. But when you're accessing your phone, you're just getting a hit of dopamine, and really you're distracting yourself. You're numbing yourself to all these other stresses around you, but that's a stress within itself. You're really not helping yourself long-term by doing that. So say instead of looking at your phone, I mean, I've actually deleted all the social media apps on my phone, and I've also enabled the Do Not Disturb feature on my phone. So it goes past 9 or 10 a.m. so that when I look at my phone first thing, I'm not waking up and looking at my phone, because I think that's the terrible worst thing you could possibly do to yourself. Mm. Instead, replace that with this positive intention of meditating. There's so many benefits of meditating, or even reading a book. It's relieves stress. So by replacing these bad behaviors with good behaviors, you're going to be much better off in the long term, no matter what stresses or behaviors you're dealing with in the present.
Well, it was amazing to have you on. That was entrepreneur Cody McClain, and you can check out his book out right now, From Foster Care to Millionaire. Quite the title. Now coming up, do you smell something and it takes you back to another time? Find out how smells can literally write the history books with sensory historian Mark Smith, next in 2 minutes. Can your nose change the way the rest of the world perceives history? Sensory historians believe so. I didn't even realize that was a thing until we decided to cover this story. And joining us now is Mark Smith, Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina, to explain how your sense of touch, taste, smell can write the history books. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This actually made me rethink the way I journal, because I realized when I journal, and if historians look back at my journals, they're not going to see that I talked about smell a lot. It's almost like I didn't have a sense of smell. So how can our smell actually shape how we all perceive history?
Well, that's a good question. And I'd ask you to reread your journal entries, because I suspect that non-visual senses inform your thinking more than you perhaps recognize. So, you know, people always say to historians who are working on the history of the senses, well, where do you get your sources? I mean, plainly, you can't record smells. And, you know, before electromagnetic recording devices, you couldn't record sounds, right? So how do you record tastes? So these things have to be lost to history. This is the kind of default argument. And that's simply not true, because text is a very powerful way to record what people thought about smells and what they thought about sounds and how they described them. And you can analyze a text, a diary, a letter, pretty much any text, really, and people will be talking about what they hear and what they smell and what they taste and what they touch, almost as much as they talk about what they see. But because we are heirs of the Enlightenment, we are, well, hostage to those conceits. So the Enlightenment was a project, really, that elevated the eye and denigrated the other senses. I mean, if we think about the word enlightenment, it's about light, right? It's about shedding light. You know, you complete the saying, what is believing? Seeing is believing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But why? Why isn't smelling believing? Why isn't touching believing? And the answer to that is really found in the Enlightenment, the long Enlightenment from the beginning of print to roughly the sort of early 1800s. And what happened in those years was essentially a series of developments that empowered the eye. There were lots.
That's why the eye became such a focus to everything we described. And just as we get into this, because we're diving deep, and you're an incredible professor, and I feel like we're in an amazing class right now. But why is this why is this relevant to today?
Well, it's relevant to today because it was relevant then. Right. So do we navigate our worlds in a purely visual fashion today? I mean, even right now, what are we doing? I'm listening. You're listening. So our ears matter, not just our eyes. And pretty much throughout our worlds, we are multisensory and intersensory creatures. So the question is, surely people in the past also shared those sensory engagements with one another. Now, they might have been different and they might have carried different weightings. But it's a kind of modern conceit, isn't it, to think that, we simply see, and somehow they didn't. And my job as a sensory historian is to uncover and unpackage the sensory past and all of its texture and all of those meanings. So I'm not, I realize, I mean, in a way, we have become, courtesy of the pandemic and the public policy surrounding COVID, quite sensory creatures, more than usual in a way, precisely because of what has been denied. Not as what has been accelerated. So, for example, we used to take touch for granted, didn't we? We'd shake hands.
Yep, we've taken a lot for granted. We're talking to Mark Smith, Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina, and a sensory historian. I think the first on our show.
Yeah, I mean, most definitely the first. And when we're looking at the bigger picture of like the history of the senses, I would love to know, especially because we are in such a huge time of like the racial inequality and the conversation, how does race play into this and the racial stereotyping kind of play into the history of the senses?
Well, that's a terrific question. I wrote a book on the making of race in American history through the senses. And this is actually a very good illustration of what I'm trying to drive at. You know, race was made really from the colonial period right through to segregation in a sensory fashion. And the reason why Southern whites, slaveholders, segregationists did this is because race as a purely visual descriptor became quite unstable after a while. So by the end of the 19th century, who was black and who wasn't was very much a kind of up to debate, which is why you had these crazy laws, like in Virginia, the one drop rule, which would define somebody as black. What segregationists did was stereotype race through the senses. So they would say, well, you don't have to see blackness or whiteness. You can hear it, right? Mm. You don't have to see it because you can look at, not just the color of skin, but the texture of skin. And this was a justification for enslavement, that enslaved people had thicker skin, therefore they didn't feel physical punishment as much, and therefore they needed more of it. If you look at the very basis of modern segregation, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, Homer Plessy was a visually white man. I mean, he was technically black in Louisiana, under Louisiana law, but he was white. I mean, he looked white, and that was the reason he was chosen by local African-American leaders to test segregation. So he had to get onto the train carriage, and he told the conductor, by the way, I'm technically black. And then the conductor said, oh, okay, we're going to segregate you. When that went to court in Louisiana, the prosecuting attorney said, well, we don't need to see his race, we can smell it. And what he was doing was stereotyping race according to smell, because when it was visually unstable, he had to anchor it another way.
Now coming up, sensory historian and professor Mark Smith is going to stick around to explain how our senses will be different post-COVID-19. We are back with sensory historian Mark Smith, Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina, as we talk about the importance of senses and specifically smell and what it could teach us about history.
And as we wrap this up, you know, I think the most important thing is us being in this pandemic. How are our senses going to change after COVID, our post-COVID, whatever that looks like?
So this is a really good illustration of why seeing is not believing, right? So if you think, go back a year from today, everybody you saw, you recognized. You recognized them because you trust your eyes. Now think today, behind masks, are you so sure about who you're seeing? Are you so certain that seeing is believing? In other words, COVID has rearranged our senses so that seeing is a much less stable sense than it was before. There have been some senses that have been utterly denied. So a year ago, we touched people readily. We shook hands. We went into supermarkets. We fingered fruit. We picked things up. There is a distinct hesitancy to touch anything. There has been a radical domestication of touch. It is no longer a public phenomenon. It's something that happens inside the home. It is something that happens between close friends. But there has been a privatization of tactility. The same is true with things like smell. When you don't get near people, when your interaction is at 6 feet, you don't have the opportunity to inhale. You don't have the opportunity to listen in the same way. You can't whisper at 6 feet. You have to shout. In a way, the world is louder because of voices, but it's also quieter because there's less traffic. People are traveling less. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been a revolution in a way. And I work a lot on the history of war and natural disasters in the senses. Nothing has had this impact with this quickly.
This makes me think of so many things, like Axe body spray is going to have to be like three times stronger. like
first of all, who is using Axe body spray?
I don't know. Like, I was thinking about any cologne. Like, they're going to have to make a stronger cologne so you could smell it 6 feet. Like, that's what I started thinking about. I think on the other side of it, I feel like if you've created a pause in your life for trying to be more present, you start to notice the smells maybe around you in your home, or if you've been outside more, like in nature, or maybe you're journaling more and you're trying to take in the space around you more than you did. So I feel like it goes both ways. Like, we've been, some senses have been taken away, but then I think that some senses have been amplified in a way.
We've re-educated ourselves sensorially, right? It's not that the world is necessarily quieter, but that our habits of listening have changed. So, for example, people hear birds more often. It's a very common observation. Oh, I'm starting to hear birds. But the reason you're hearing birds, they've always been there. Their sound is always there. It was just drowned out by other soundscapes.
And now the only thing I'm smelling is like the smoke from these wildfires.
Oh, that too.
That's really the big thing where it makes you not even want to go outside. And to be honest, I feel like my smell has kind of diluted. There's things that I would smell coming in my house from coming from work, being like, oh, it smells so good in here, versus now I'm here all the time. I don't really know if I can tell the difference.
Yeah, and think about how that's going to affect your memory, right? Because smell is interesting. There are no nose lids. To breathe, you have to smell. It's just a function of living. It's a very transgressive scent. So smell inflects memory very powerfully. Some of your earliest memories are going to be triggered by smell. And now your memory of this particular point in time is going to be triggered by the smell of wildfires.
Yeah, and you could either be traumatized by that, triggered by that, or have a beautiful feeling around it, which is why maybe like cookies and holidays, you have that smell that we all remember. Mark Smith, thanks again for being here. This has been a pleasure, a sensory experience of sorts.
You're welcome.
Again, Mark Smith is a sensory historian, Carolina Distinguished Professor of History at the University of South Carolina. We're back, and a friendly reminder that we have a podcast, and if you haven't checked it out, well, you should, because we post all our shows in full, as well as our amazing interviews. How to find it is just go to the radio.com app, search Let's Go There, and also subscribe so you're notified when we post new episodes and to be part of our podcast family.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so many good things that we've covered that everyone needs to catch up on. You'll be so informed by the time you're finished. I mean,
be that person who brings cool conversations to your Zoom dinner.
I mean, you're okay. I don't know if Shira's going to be the one giving you the cool conversations to give to others, but
all the cool cats out there. Okay. Let's get into some what's trending this hour. Michael Cohen has offered a very blunt explanation for why Republicans, including himself, have supported President Donald Trump and everything that he's done.
This was stupid. You know, we were a bunch of sycophants. He's very much like a cult leader. And when he, you know, when you're in his good grace, you believe that you have this enormous amount of power, which you do, and he somehow manages to convince you to use that power for bad, right? I mean, look at some of the things I talk about in the book in terms of feeding his ego and fixing polls.
Yeah, basically he's a cult leader. Okay, will that stop anything? Not sure.
Michael Cohen is just so infuriating. He was on The View this week and he was just awful. Like, I just don't like him. And the fact that he's trying to have this moment of reckoning where he's like now speaking out and he's saying things like this, it's just like, girl, go sit down somewhere. Don't you have like a house arrest thing that you got to go to? Like, I don't know. Like, I just feel like he is annoying to me. Very annoying.
During that appearance that you just heard on MSNBC, he told host Joy Reid also that if Trump does lose the November 3rd election, this is what he predicts, that he will say it was rigged and use Attorney General William Barr to invalidate ballots that he will say are fake in order to stay in office.
It's not going to happen. If that honestly happens, I am actually afraid, to be honest. I was thinking about this the other day. I'm like kind of nervous the day after election, like depending on if, you know, Democrats win and Joe Biden wins. I'm so unsure if it's going to be complete anarchy or like what's going to happen.
Let's just focus on getting people to the polls. This like whole let's predict what happens the next day or what happens. Like, let's just make sure things work right the day of the election, right? Money. And enough people go out there and vote.
I need to be prepared if we have to make a quick jump to Canada.
All right. Now, President Donald Trump says he expects to get a report today about Oracle's bid for the Chinese-owned app TikTok. And Oracle's the one that has come out on top. Of course, people were talking about Microsoft at a certain point. He admitted there is no legal path to letting the U.S. Treasury get a cut of the deal. That was a proposition that experts had criticized as unprecedented and possibly illegal. He said to White House reporters last night about Oracle's interest in TikTok, "I'm not prepared to sign off on anything. I have to see the deal." Now, a lot of people have raised concerns about the deal, fearing that ByteDance, that's the Chinese company that owns TikTok, would basically maintain access to the information on the 100 million TikTok users in the US, even if this whole Oracle thing happens.
See, I don't know. TikTok, it may be the end.
Or just the beginning. Evil laugh place right here. Now, former President Barack Obama's long-awaited memoir is coming out this year, but not until after the November election. Wonder if that was strategic or it just happened. He tweeted early today that the book called A Promised Land will be available November 17th. He said, "There's no feeling like finishing a book, and I'm proud of this one. In A Promised Land, I try to provide an honest accounting of my presidency, the forces we grapple with as a nation, and how we can heal our divisions and make democracy work for everybody."
Love that. I mean, this book is like 768 pages.
I was just about to say, Ryan, are you willing to read an almost 800-page book?
I read the Harry Potter books when I was 12. I'm a little busier now, so I don't know if I would be able to, but we can try.
But hey, if he does that audiobook, I will listen. That voice. So there you have it. That is Obama's book coming out in November. All right, that was what's trending this hour. We're moving into the Tea Report. What's up, Ryan?
All right, we got your Tea Report, those pop culture moments that are trending right now. Stassi Schroeder, if you don't remember her, she's from a reality show, Vanderpump Rules, and she got fired for some racist activity that was ended up coming to light, and she did her first person interview. Like, she's actually the first time she's speaking out, and she did it with the one and only Tamron Hall, where she basically admitted that she was a Karen years before it was a thing. Here is this clip.
Yes, Wow was right. And I have to say, I've been wanting to talk about this podcast more, because going through these past few months and working with a teacher and learning about Black history and just the obstacles that Black people face every single day, I look back on that podcast and I am so embarrassed that I even had those thoughts, much less put it out there, because I was that Karen. I was a Karen.
Now she's basically trying to, you know, talk about how she's really aware and she should have never made those comments before. And yeah, she's apologizing. Whatever. Ooh, oh my goodness. Moving on. That almost took me out. Moving on. Little Nas X. He's writing a children's book. Oh my goodness.
All right.
Now, he tweeted on Tuesday that C is for Country, his upcoming picture book, will arrive on January 5th of next year. He said, I'm dropping the best kids book of all time, which is kind of him making a joke referencing to Kanye West's notorious 2009 VMAs where he stage crashed.
That's all right. I like it.
Well, he goes on to share that the book is being published under Random House Kids. That is a division of Penguin Random House and is currently available for pre-order. So that's super exciting. And that is your Pop Culture Tea Report.
All right. Now, as wildfires rage on in California and there's hurricanes and storms everywhere else, we can't help but wonder if smaller cities will be ready for a great climate migration. And what does that look like? We discuss that next in 2 minutes. Every year, millions are displaced from their homes by climate change. Of course, we've got hurricanes, we've got floods, we've got fires happening right now as we see.
We've got
pandemics. And a lot of people are talking about the Great Migration, and that means something different right now. We're in it. The things we've read in history books, well, we are living it right now. So what does that mean? And what are these new cities that we might be migrating to? Well, we've got a really great guest to talk about this with us today. Thaddeus Pulaski, who's a managing director for the Center for Resilient Cities and Landscapes at Columbia University. Thanks for being here.
Sure. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fascinated by this topic. I'm talking about it. And you might not even realize that you're talking about this with your friends, as your friends might be talking about moving to different cities right now or not being able to go outside to breathe. And what does that mean for their lives and their children's? So how bad is the climate migrant crisis right now, Thaddeus?
Well, you know, it comes in like fits and starts, right? When there's a big event like Katrina or Sandy, a lot of people move away. I think, you know, in New York right now, everyone's talking about people fleeing because of the quarantine and maybe not coming back. So there are these push events, right, that like make people decide it's time to move. But then there's the slow pull of other things like insurance prices going up. And in Miami and lots of other cities, people are talking about climate gentrification, where a lot of people are getting priced out because it becomes too expensive to live in some places.
Which we will be talking about in this conversation, because I have a lot of concerns.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm from a small town in western Pennsylvania where I grew up. I was sort of like an economic migrant because there's really not much economic life. But our country is filled with thousands of these cities that were built up for people to live in, like during the heyday of industrialism, and then were largely abandoned. We have a lot of cities that are like half abandoned all over this country. Some of them are coming back. Pittsburgh, Detroit is starting to come back in some ways, but not nearly the same levels of population that existed there before. So a lot of these Rust Belt and other cities are saying, hey, you know, we could actually support a lot more people in the future, and we don't have wildfires, and we have a lot of water and other things that might be useful in the long term. Big question is how do we make those places actually livable and attractive? I mean, obviously Detroit is a, you know, a major city with a lot going on there, but other cities like my hometown, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, what would it take to make a place like Johnstown a great place for people who are leaving the coasts or leaving the fire ravaged areas to find there?
Yeah, really important questions to ask. Again, that is Thaddeus Pulaski, who's from Columbia University, Managing Director for the Center for Resilient Cities and Landscapes, as we talk about climate migrants right now.
Yeah, and you spoke about gentrification. I felt like that is a huge part that plays into this, because how does it really play into this? Because even if people have to move and if they can't afford to go anywhere, like really what's the point? And also I think about how this could really accelerate the patterns of discrimination and conflict that we often see as a side effect of gentrification or like systemic racism.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think that that's at the heart of the whole question here is how, you know, what are the principles, what are the kinds of policies and principles that we want to adopt as a society as this redistribution of population happens. I mean, this is really an opportunity for reparations, I think, in many ways. We've had this, the last 40 years of suburbanization has really been about securing white property in the suburbs. And that's, you know, plays into Trump's political strategy, or the Republican political strategy now, to turn suburbs and rural areas into like white privilege islands, whereas the cities are, you know, like democratic run cities are sort of not in the calculus of the future of this country. But at the same time, we know that those are the engines of all of our progress, all of our culture, all of our economy, and also, you know, the promise of multicultural America is really in those cities. So I think this redistribution of population might mean that a lot of places, suburbs and small towns in general, get a lot more in many ways made to be welcoming multiculturally, places where everybody can own property, you know, and the squeeze on property ownership in cities is a large part of the reason for gentrification and displacement.
Totally. And on that note, as we wrap things up, what do cities need to do to prepare? Like, we talk about these havens, how do we go about building one?
Well, I mean, one thing is we need a Green New Deal, you know? I mean, that's the most essential thing, is that we really need to build a new economy that's beyond fossil fuels. I mean, obviously we've got to adapt to climate change, but at the same time, the transition, a just transition to a new kind of economy would provide a lot of jobs. And where those jobs could be would be some of the places that might be more secure against the hazards of climate change. So the old steel mills in the town where I'm from could become places where solar panels are manufactured. Jobs are critical. Infrastructure is critical. We really need, I think the pandemic, 2020 is teaching us so much about the frailties in our society and economy, and just the incredible injustice in the opportunities in education and housing and everything else. So I would feel that if we could mount a Green New Deal in a, you know, Biden-Harris administration, that would actually make these places more livable in terms of infrastructure, in terms of educational opportunities, job opportunities, we would be fulfilling a lot of this promise of America.
All right, Thaddeus Pulaski, thank you so much again. I know we just are like touching on the surface of it, but still a lot
really
of stuff to think about.
Yeah,
definitely. Again, Thaddeus is Managing Director for the Center for Resilient Cities and Landscapes at Columbia University. Now coming up, fall is almost here, which means seasonal affective disorder could soon be impacting your love life. We discuss how to fight back next in 2 minutes. As we move into the fall, I can't believe I'm even saying that. What is going on with the year? Mm-hmm. Seasonal affective disorder could be wreaking havoc on your life, but not just your life, your love life. Here to explain how you can fight back and regain your libido during this time. The leaves might fall, but your libido doesn't need to fall. Is Stephanie Gerlich. She's a sex and relationship therapist. Thanks again for being here.
Always. Thank you so much for having me.
So we all know how, well, maybe people don't know how seasonal affective disorder impacts your life and how it works. Can we just like explain that first before we get into this?
Yeah. So the short version is our bodies are made to respond to sunlight. Sunlight helps us make vitamin D, which keeps us healthy physically. It also stimulates our melatonin and our serotonin. Mm-hmm. So when the seasons change and we get into those winter months where there are shorter days and less sunlight, our bodies react to that. And it can be really disruptive for some people.
Yeah. And a lot of people deal with that, but then how does it impact your sex life? I mean, I would think and assume, and I'm not an expert here, but if you're feeling like your mental health is really down and you're feeling down about yourself, you're not going to want to have sex or connect with someone.
Yeah, absolutely. When we are experiencing depression symptoms, when we're, you know, not really able to find joy in the things that we usually take pleasure in, when we're feeling worse about ourselves and we're not feeling great about our bodies, our minds, when we're cloudy and our memories are foggy, all of those things are triggered by the seasonal changes, and all of those directly impact libido. We need to kind of have a clear, positive headspace in order to have really fun, engaging sex. So for people with seasonal affective disorder, that seasonal change can really cause some disruptions in their sex life.
I always think about those couples who are either Black, Indigenous, or people of color, and they might be in interracial relationships. And obviously, this is a heightened stress, and there's probably a lot of racial anxiety going on. How do they have that conversation? If one of them are just not feeling it because of everything happening in the world, how do you communicate that with your partner?
I'm hearing that so much from so many of my clients these days. We are going through a time where everything feels awful for a lot of people.
Yeah.
We are confronting some really huge social issues, and those are big things as a society, but very personal things to individuals. My clients of color are watching what's happening in the world right now, and that's having an impact on their sense of self, on their depression levels, on their ability to like really find joy and positivity in the world right now, much like we were talking about with seasonal affective disorder. So one of the best things to do is to be open about that and to talk out what is kind of dragging you down right now.
Mm-hmm.
And for partners, just listening is huge. You don't necessarily have to relate personally. You don't necessarily have to be able to say, I get it. But being able to say, I understand that you're feeling that, and I know how hard that is for you, and I want to respect your process right now. How can I best support you in this moment is tremendous.
Definitely.
For a lot of people, physical touch is healing. So once we start to unpack that, sex can become a very supportive, comforting thing. But we need to start by recognizing what's holding us back.
Yeah. Sex and relationship therapist Stephanie Gerlich joins us right now as we talk about seasonal affective disorder hitting and impacting your libido, as well as everything happening in the world, of course. So you talked about what couples can do if one couple is feeling it, another couple isn't. What if both people are just down?
So I think it's okay to say we're not up for sex right now. I think that there are natural ebbs and flows in every relationship. And whether that's triggered by world events or by seasonal changes, it's okay to say, I'm just not feeling it. And it's okay to say, you know what, neither am I. So for those couples, I suggest just kind of stepping back and focusing on touch. It doesn't need to be penetrative, hot, and heavy sex. Sometimes it can just be giving and receiving touch, petting, massages, stroking one another. It can trigger all of those endorphins and all those wonderful things that we need to kind of offset the other things that are impacting our minds right now without putting a lot of pressure on people to perform sexually.
But when do you know it's coming to the time where, like, if you notice your partner is really experiencing a level of depression that may need some form of medical help? Like, how do you even bring that up?
Mm-hmm.
So that comes back to the question I said earlier, that how can I best support you right now? Starting from that, asking them what they need. And then from there saying, you know, I wonder if this wouldn't be something that our family doctor could help us with. I wonder if this wouldn't be something that you would benefit from talking to somebody that's not me about could be really helpful.
Yeah. And I heard you say that earlier, but people like me, I'm just always going to be like, oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. You know, like you know something's not right, but people, the person going through it, they might not want to be a burden, you know? And so that it's kind of difficult navigating those spaces when your partner is like not really fessing up to what's going on.
Absolutely. So in those cases, you can very gently speak from the eye. The last thing we want to do is make our depressed partner feel worse by making them feel shameful or guilty about their low libido. But it is okay to say, you know, I miss you. You know, I miss touching you. I miss being held by you. Is that something that we could do? And use that to kind of open that door. Often the, like you're talking about, Ryan, the I'm fine, I'm good people, they put up a brave face and they might not necessarily be willing to talk about what they need, but they still want to be responsive to their partners. They're still trying to be there. And so giving a way that they can support you or could do that is an easy lift. You're not saying, you know, I want a rough and tumble 8 hours of sex. You're saying, you know, I want to be cuddled on the couch.
Or maybe put on some music, get up and dance, move your body, sweat a bit together. Stephanie Gerlich, we love having you on. Thanks again. We appreciate it. And of course, check out her new book, The Leather Couch, Clinical Practice with Kinky Clients, out right now. Coming up, the U.S. has its first trans senator. That's next in our Yas Queen of the Day. We're wrapping up the show as usual with our Yas Queen of the Day.
Yes, Queen.
This one goes to Mickey Guyton, who made history at the 55th Academy of Country Music Awards last night. The country star, who's 37, same age as me,
performed her hit What Are You Gonna Tell Her with Keith Urban on piano, and that makes her the first Black female country artist to perform her own song at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Very historic moment. Here's a clip.
What are you gonna tell her when she's wrong? Will you just shrug and say it's been that way all along? What are you gonna tell her when she figures out that all this time you built her up just so the world could let her down? Yeah, what do you tell her?
Now, how incredible was that? Following her performance, she was praised everywhere on social media, including by fellow singers. Kelsey Ballerini wrote, "Wow, Nikki Guyton, that is a performance that will make people listen, think, and change, me included. You are a force."
So I was very hesitant because I found out about her last night, and I was hesitant to like actually be public about my support because I'm just never really sure where Black folks in country music fall, like when it comes politically, or like, are they ones who are wearing the red Make America Great Again hats? And I looked around and I followed her on social, and I just love her because all she's about, like all she is about is, you know, women empowerment and really speaking up on Black issues, especially being a Black woman in country music.
Yeah.
And so there's something so powerful that she's using and taking up space in the way that she is that's really helping make a more of a space and making country music more inclusive to other Black artists who really want to make a place there. Because girl, she has a song. Wait, let me go find it. I have to find it because it's so good. I was
another song, not just the song she performed.
No, another song. It's called Heaven Down Here. It's like the first song on her new EP called Bridges, and it is incredible. And so I don't know. I'm obsessed with her. I need to find out more. Now, if she comes out talking about she's a Trump supporter, then we can really talk about my complicated feelings towards her. But we'll see.
Until then, she's great.
Yes.
Okay. Now, another Yas Queen today, trans Democrat Sarah McBride, is making history also as the first out transgender state senator ever elected in the U.S. after she won the state legislative primary in Delaware. Huge.
Huge news.
Yeah, she was also the national press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign and author of the book Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. So that is a big deal. And also, before this, she was also the first trans person to speak at a major party convention. In 2016, she addressed the Democratic National Convention. So she keeps on doing it. Sarah McBride, remember that name. And that does it for our Yas Queen of the Day.
Yes, Queen.
And coming up on tomorrow's show, you know, President Trump just signed an executive order around patriotic education. We spoke about it a bit earlier. We're going to dive in more tomorrow. What does that mean and how it can impact schools moving forward? Plus the psychology behind why some people hide that they have COVID-19. That's tomorrow. Let's go there. 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on Channel Q. And again, we have a podcast. Join our podcast family. Just go to the radio.com app, search Let's Go There, and subscribe so you are notified when we post new episodes. We are sending you love and light.
And honey, remember to slay.
See you tomorrow. Have a great night.
Bye, y'all.